Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, drama, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
On 106.5 FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Mr. Eric Shapiro is here from his movie making.
Hi, Al. How you doing? Yeah, I missed all summer because I was making a movie.
Well, how's that going?
Yeah, I missed you. No, it's going well. I'm taking a break before I edit because it was very demanding and I have other things to catch up on with business and clients, but it came out good, so I'm excited about it.
A lot of stress in the movie business now streaming and everything, right? And did the strike affect you at all, or...?
Sort of, you know, it became impolitic to talk about it too much on social media, even though it was a non-union production, because, you know, one wants to show solidarity with the strikers, which I had. So I sort of was just, going about the process because it had been scheduled, before the strikes began. So, but it was non-union. So technically I was at a remove from that.
Okay. Let's jump right into it because we've got a great guest waiting here. We've got Mr. Richard Chismar, who's got a new book. It's the follow-up to The Boogeyman. It's called Becoming the Boogeyman. So thanks for being here, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
Richard, wow. So now, if I remember right, now you're kind of focused on a lot about the obsession with true crime in society and stuff like that. Is there something about that subject that sticks with you, or a reason why you kind of focus on that?
You know what? It's just people ask. It's probably the first or second most asked question that I get when I'm doing press for a book or just a general interview. Is when did that attraction to the dark side of humanity take place for you, and what is it about it that does attract you? So it's something that I've discussed fairly often, and I've given a lot of thought, and. I just it's something that I'm curious about because I think there's that fine line between people like me. Well, start with the reading audience or the viewing audience, between people who really enjoy having that as part of their entertainment, whether it's scary movies or dark movies, or books or comics or whatever it may be. And then there's, you kind of skip over the next line and there's the creators, people like me who people like Eric who do this for a living. And then, there's another line over there where you kind of skip past that. And that's where you kind of get, it gets a little unhealthy because it runs into obsession. And, these are the folks who are kind of running around with, t-shirts with Charlie Manson and Ted Bundy on the front. And, you know, the women who are writing letters to serial killers in prison and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of blurry lines in between there, you know?
It looks like from the synopsis of the book, I can tell it's being kept under wraps because I'm sure some shocking things happen, but there's this dichotomy between people involved walking away from the story of a lifetime in trade for keeping their loved ones safe versus sort of getting up, caught up in the darkness you're describing. Can you shed a little more light on exactly what that dynamic is in the story?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about the two Boogeyman books is that, you know, some of the reviewers think it was this brilliant move. I made myself the lead character. I'm sure plenty of other, you know, readers think, you know, what an egotistical, you know, idiot. Honestly, it was the only way I could tell the first book, Chasing the Boogeyman. It's, you know, that book is set back in 1988. I'm freshly graduated from college with a journalism degree, and I moved home, you know, back into the house I grew up with my parents for like 6 months before I get married, to save a few dollars. And these killings, you know, are occurring in my small hometown in Maryland. And the reason I did this is because I really did move home. All of that came, you know, all of that was true. I set it in my real hometown in the real house. You know, I used my friends and family as characters. And really the only thing that was fictionalized were the crimes, were the murders. And what I did in that book that really connects with this book is I tried to be as honest as I could about, you know, my involvement in the dark side of the world. As far as, you know, Chasing the Boogeyman at that age, I was working on the second issue of Cemetery Dance magazine, which has been around for 35 years now. I was submitting my own short stories to various horror and mystery magazines, and beginning to sell a few. So, I was trying to build a career as a creator in this world, and also publishing a magazine and kind of setting down the seeds for becoming a book publisher also. And I tried to be really honest when I told the story, because people would ask me all the time how much of it was true. And I said, well, everything except the murders. And even then, I tried to, you know, be as honest as I could and how I would react to them. And in one scene, you know, I remember I made a comparison to the weather reporters you see, you know, say on the Weather Channel when a hurricane's about to hit the coast. And obviously these folks aren't wishing this to happen. They're not wishing for, you know, millions of dollars of damage to be done and people to lose their houses and floods and the whole thing. But they still can't really disguise that internal excitement that they can't help but feel, because this is their life. This is their job. And these things are happening. And it's one of those moments. And I tried to, you know, shine that spotlight on myself in both books, actually. And you know, including times when it didn't necessarily, exhibit a positive, you know, spotlight on myself. And so between the first and the second book is modern day. It takes place in, you know, now. I've made a career out of this. I've been successful. I've had films made. I've had books published. I've worked with Stephen King, you know, everything like real life. Some people don't like that, you know, in the book. There's, you know, this is a whole new world than, you know, compared to 1988. So there's message boards, there's blogs, there's people who like to say that, you know, my house with the nice pond in the side yard is the house that the boogeyman built. And that I've, you know, made a career on blood money and things like that. So, that's the dynamic I'm exploring. You know, when the book jacket copy talks about, you know, walking away from the story of a lifetime, you know, it's talking about me. You know, to what extent am I willing to risk everything to follow this story and to continue to examine, you know, what is happening across that line? And I think what you see is, In some cases, it's more of a quest for understanding than it is an obsession with, you know, the bad stuff. I think becoming the boogeyman is very much me coming to terms with the idea that you don't necessarily always, you're not always able to understand. Sometimes you just have to let it go and just, you know, keep living and accept the fact that it's, you know, it's unexplainable.
You know, I've written 32 crime books now, and I've been through that experience. But you put yourself into this as the main character. I can't help but wonder, when you're living as that main character and going through the process of writing the book, now that you've written two books really centered about some of your own experiences, how do you think that's changed you?
I think, you know, like I said, I've already been very kind of thoughtful and aware of, you know, of the dynamic that exists, but I'm even more aware now, and I'm even more thoughtful. You know, the book I'm about to finish is a standalone horror novel. You know, I can't say it's affected the writing of it. It's made me, you know, go tamer, or it's made me, kind of flavor my writing or my storyline in any particular way. So, yeah, no, it hasn't really, you know, it hasn't really affected anything other than my already cluttered head. But, yeah, I think it is an interesting thing to write about yourself. And that comes from true crime books. You know, the true crime books that I've found I've enjoyed the most have been, you know, the ones where the author has allowed him or herself to become part of that story. They feel so passionately about it, or it really was, you know, factored in their personal life so that they had no other choice. And that's what the Boogeyman books are. They're kind of my version of true crime books, you know, where I can kind of make it up instead of having to do all the research like the real true crime writers.
Do you feel solvent on this whole, in this area, when push comes to shove and your head's on the pillow? Do you feel solvent in terms of using darkness in your work and profiting off it, or is it something you struggle with, or do you feel morally you're at peace with it?
Yeah, you know what, morally I am at peace with it. That's the thing. I think that's why I had so much fun poking fun at myself in becoming the Boogeyman and kind of making me the bad guy for some people. The story is told, through a variety of techniques, and some of it is, you know, message boards, posts, and yeah, I had fun, you know, saying bad things about myself, because when my head hit the pillow, you know, I'm comfortable. And that's the thing. I've said this before in interviews about, you know, my attraction to true crime books, you know, was a fairly, you know, recent one over the last decade or so. And what I discovered, you know, by reading stacks of these things, is you can find out very quickly whether the book is written well and written from a good place, from a pure place of someone who truly wanted to honor the survivors and you know, the victim and you know, explore, you know, the perpetrator in a dignified way. And you know, then there's books where you read it and you're like, okay, this guy got offered $5,000 and just dashed this off in 2 weeks, and
right,
and it shows. And so, yeah, I'm good with that. And I mean, you know, again, it's kind of diabolical in some ways, but with both books, I would have preferred to not have a novel, you know, printed on the front cover so that people would have, you know, perhaps even, you know, believed it more. A lot of people say, you know, they miss that. They miss the disclaimer in the front of the book. So they spent a lot of time Googling. And, you know, my initial plans were for Chasing the Boogeyman to Blair Witch the audience. I wanted them to believe this was the real thing. And, you know, I wanted to plant a fake website online, fake newspaper articles. I wanted to shoot a little behind the scenes documentary of the actual thing, and use some of the same actors that I used in the photographs in the book, because there's photographs at the end of each chapter. But my publisher's legal department squashed that really quickly.
Especially like in this day and age, when the you know, with fake news and people like really not having a handle on what's real, like I can see it getting really out of control. Like, you know, like even when the cat's out of the bag and it's made clear that it's fictional, if you even at one point along the way suggested otherwise, like they would never let it go, and it would just like lead to all kinds of madness.
Yeah, I mean, surprisingly, it was my oldest son who is not the most conservative when it comes to, you know, risk taking and filmmaking or storytelling. He's young and bold, but he was the first one to tell me, like, he's like, Dad, you can't do that. You know, you're gonna like drive the housing prices down in Edgewood and
yeah.
You know, you're gonna start all these rumors and people are gonna buy guns and you know, and when I hung up from that, you know, first or second phone conference with the legal department of Simon Schuster, I was like, son of a gun, he's right. But yeah, it even with the disclaimer and the novel printed on front, there are hundreds of messages here from folks who have said, oh, I bought it all the way to the end. I bought it until I Googled for the sixth or seventh time, and then I figured it out, or I saw some comments.
Right, right.
Including a handful of people who got mad, who were angry. They felt like I cheated and I pulled the wool over their eyes and the photographs weren't fair. And I was just like, you know, did you get your $25 worth of entertainment? Because that's what it's designed to be.
And the fact that you're in it also, everybody inevitably, no matter what they know or don't know going in, they're going to be wondering where the line is at all times. Like,
right.
So, I mean, that remains fun. But I think it's good to let it out from the get-go that it's a novel, because it creates I think it creates a more like joyful good humor about it to some extent. That it's, there's like a sense of gamesmanship.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. And you know, ultimately, like I said, that's the nice thing is I did hear from a lot of readers who felt it was so immersive that they started knowing it was a novel, but then they started questioning it. And I think in today's, you know, climate, that's probably the best I could hope for.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
What did you have in mind when you started these books? Like, and did it turn out the way you expected them to?
You know, when I started Chasing the Boogeyman, I was not a main character. There's an introduction which kind of, you know, glosses over the story in a way. And you know, my intentions were, you know, normal. Just let's whet the reader's appetite and then go into detail about this town. And what I was doing is I was following a true crime book format. You know, it was not, you know, narratively, it's a slow start because the first chapter is about the history of the town. And then a long section, a very nostalgic long section on my kind of growing up there and how it was our world and then how those boundaries, you know, gradually, you know, expanded outward. But the point was, is I wanted them to get to know the town, you know, intimately and share those experiences of my past so that they could hopefully feel what I felt when these murders started, which was this sense of invasion and wrongness, you know, to my safe place in the world that, you know, even though I graduated from college, I was, you know, it was that weird age where you're on the cusp of adulthood, but you're not quite there yet, you know, and I'm living in the bedroom I grew up in, you know, so I said, you know, I'm looking out the window at the ghosts of my childhood. So there was a lot to play with there. But I got halfway through that introduction and I realized, okay, this is me. I'm not trying to disguise the fact that it's my town, my old bedroom and all this. I said, so why disguise the fact that it's, you know, really me and it's this other, you know, narrator. So that's how it happened. I went back and I started the intro over and I, you know, kind of put myself there and the book just flew because of that. It was, you know, I can't remember how many, you know, people are murdered in the book, but it was so much fun to write, which sounds horrible. But all that stuff. And then when I was finished, I had no idea what I had. I said, this is a really strange, my agent didn't know I was writing it. I was supposed to be writing something else, but this, you know, just took hold of me. And when I told her on the phone, you know, she was really surprised because I don't get out to book conferences or book shows very often. And I'm very much behind the scenes. So the idea that I put myself into a book was kind of a strange choice. Fortunately, she loved it. And it went from there and Simon & Schuster bought it right away. And the reader reaction was really positive. You know, I had that moment a week before the book came out, kind of where I am right now with the second book, where I thought, what, and there was a lot of buzz. And I just thought, what are people going to think? Because it's really not this big story. It's kind of a campfire story about the boogeyman coming to town and about some, you know, schmuck from Edgewood, Maryland. You know, who's going to care about this? And what I was thrilled to realize as reader response started to come in was it wasn't just about me. It was about everyone who grew up in a town like that. And I heard from so many readers who said, you know, I forgot what it was like to pop tar bubbles on the road or to jump ramps on my bike. Or, you know, to climb trees and have crabapple battles with my buddies in the neighborhood. And so that was the cool thing it was a good reminder for me that, you know, you're never really just writing. No matter how personal the story is, it's always, you know, something that you're going to find the connection with readers with. So that was a neat after effect for it.
Nice. Yeah, that leads to something else I was going to mention in terms of when you commented, oh, you know, X amount of people were murdered, which sounds horrible, et cetera. I mean, I think the bottom line when it comes to this, in terms of darkness being counterbalanced with light and these nostalgic memories coming up for the readers, is that really all comes down to your insight. I mean, I think with any book and any subject and any author, that's what really is the quote-unquote selling point. It's like it's the insight you bring to it, regardless of the subject. And if that insight captures it in a truthful way, you've done your job.
Right. Right. Yeah, I agree. You know. Yeah, and the first book was very much kind of a love story to my hometown and growing up. And the examination of evil. And then this, you know, all these years later, this one's kind of a love story to family and my wife, who is the only person through two books who hates being in the book. She's very much behind the scenes, and it's just she hasn't read it yet. She refuses to read it until it comes out in paperback. She said, that way I don't have to discuss it with everyone who reads it at the signings and everywhere else. I can just say, I haven't read it yet. Don't tell me.
Is she in it a good deal? Does she just factor in like at the margins, or is she fully depicted, or how's that work?
Oh yeah, she's in the second one. She's a full character. I mean, she's you know, the like I said, it's modern day. So my youngest is out at the University of Virginia at college. My oldest is up in the attic bedroom, you know, writing his own stories for his Patreon page and selling his first novel. And I'm doing my thing, and she's doing her thing, and you know, everyone kind of gets sucked into this web because of my past and what's going on in the present. So yeah, she's a major part of it. And, you know, in the first one, she was my girlfriend. She was in college, so she was definitely just on the peripheral. But this one, yeah, she's at my side for a decent amount of it. And, she's,
anything defamatory?
No.
That's just all you have to be careful about.
I would threaten her. I'd be like, yeah, it's, you know, I think I'm going to have some romance in this chapter. And she'd be like, yeah, make your own dinner for the next month too. So no, it's funny. My friends are all thrilled to be a part of it. You know, my kids don't care, but they think it's cool. And, you know, on like that, but, and my neighbors are fine with it and excited, but, she wants nothing to do with it. So.
I hear you. What is her particular, I won't stay on this much longer, but what is her particular concern about it?
She's just a behind the scenes person, you know. Neither one of us like to, you know, there's because of the success of the last book and the Stephen King books. Yeah, I mean, there's days where she comes home and she's like, okay, I was at the bank, I did the deposit slip. New teller said, oh, Chismar, the writer, are you related to the writer? Yeah, that's, you know, I'm married to him. Oh, he talked about you and chasing the boogeyman. And then she's that afternoon I had a vet appointment. The woman at the desk said the same thing. You know, we live in a fairly small town. So she just doesn't like that kind of attention, and nor do I. I've been in bookstores quite a few times when people have had my books in their hands, and I've never have and never would say a word, where I know plenty of writers who'd be like, hey, that's me, which is fine. I get it. You know, it's a cool moment. It's a cool feeling, but no, not me. I've seen people reading, you know, a book from me, you know, on the beach. And there's no way I'm saying anything. I might try to sneak a picture of them and send it to my my kids, but that's it. So yeah, neither
you
one.
Tell them it's a
like
terrible
that,
book.
No. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Write that down. It's an awful book. That's
it
terrible.
Sucks. So you're the one who wasted my $20.
Rich, when it comes to depicting yourself, do you enhance or romanticize yourself at all, or do you try and get the most straight up authentic version you could imagine? Reacting within the fictional scenario.
I really do. And both of these.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Books, I really did my best to be honest. I teased my family in that in the second book, you know, that I was like I worked out twice a day, 5 days a week. And, you know, I found the first body because I was out jogging for, you know, training for a triathlon. They're like, Dad, you know, your idea of exercise is fishing.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that. So I threatened them with that, but I really didn't. I feel like that would have pulled me so far out of the story that, it just wouldn't have worked for me. So I tried to, like I said, even when it didn't necessarily shine a good light on me, sometimes I, you know, there's a scene in the first book where there's a photograph has blown away from one of the memorials that was left for the victim. And it's, you know, it's like 25 yards down the sidewalk and I pick it up and I look at it. And instead of walking back there, I put it in my pocket and I take it. And it's like that was a coin flip for me. Cause I'm like, if I really was obsessed with what was going on in my town, knowing me, you know, that would have been kind of creepy for me to do. So I probably would have put it back. And I'm like, but you know what? You never know. There was like 50 other pictures there. So they're not going to miss one. So there were moments like that where it was kind of an arm wrestle. But most of the time, it was a pretty easy, like I would have known what I would have done. I believe it.
And it serves, I'm sure it serves the completely imaginary component of it to steep your own personality as deeply in realism as possible. Because then everything that stems from it just benefits from that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's, and like I said, both books were a joy to write. And just, you know, the first book, I tell people, I'm like, my parents have been gone for over a decade, both of them, but not when I was writing the book. I was living in their house, eating my mom's cooking and talking to my dad. And, you know, that's kind of a unique opportunity for a writer, you know, to actually be writing about himself and these people as they were. Some of my friends who are no longer here.
What was the gap? How many years was it between books in real life and in fiction? What were the gaps?
Fiction, Chasing the Boogeyman is 1988.
Right.
But like I said, I'm a fresh faced, you know, graduate with a degree and that I have no intentions of using because I'm going to start this little magazine and publishing company. And then the second book is set in 2021. Or is it 2021 or is it 2023? Hell, I don't know. But you know, I'm in mid fifties and it's, you know, everything is as accurate as could be. I mean, I even wrote about my own house and all of that, which is, you know, people have said, I don't know if I would have done that. I'm like, ah, we got to get security system. We got cameras all over the place. I think it's okay.
Yeah. Well, and wait, so when was The Boogeyman published? Like, it takes place in 80.
Yeah. The first one was 21.
Okay, so there I'm getting the time first. Is there any thought in your mind of, you know, when you're in your 60s, you follow up on it again? Does it leave? Is the door open for that?
Yeah, the door is wide open, and I had no intentions. I had no intentions of writing the second book, but I was out mowing the lawn one day and not thinking about it, not trying to think about it, and in the space of 5 minutes, the entire first chapter to the sequel, including the big reveal, that there's a reveal that happens at the end of chapter one in Becoming the Boogeyman that ties it directly to Chasing the Boogeyman, and should hopefully make a lot of mouths drop open when they read it. And that's what happened when I was mowing the lawn. 5 minutes, I was just like, that whole first chapter was there in my lap, culminating with that reveal. And then by the time I, you know, took a shower, I was like, man, I got to write this book. So,
oh, wow.
I had signed a 2-book deal with Simon & Schuster, and I just, you know, they wanted the standalone to be next. And I was like, I said, I'm sorry, but this book's going to come out one way or another. So we're either going to have to extend the deadline or you can do the sequel next. So we ended up just doing the sequel next. So I'm finishing the standalone now, but that's what happened. I had no intention. And same thing when I was writing this, no intention of there being another book. But when I got to the last chapter, there was one and only one way I could end it. And I realized that as I was writing that chapter, and it leaves the door wide open. So I was just like, I guess I'm coming back and there's one more book where I'm going to torture my wife and write about myself. And there are days where, you know, writing about yourself is just like, this is weird. And, you know, people are going to stop believing that I am a hermit and, you know, would prefer to stay home and stay out of the spotlight if I keep doing this. But there's one more chapter to tell. So when that's done, I'll put it away.
Got it. Now, is there a world in which you might imagine forward into a speculative version of yourself who's older? Or you would just wait, or is the other version a couple years from now, or do you not want to say too much?
You know what? It would have to be a direct continuation, but that doesn't necessarily mean it and I haven't decided which path to take yet. I was going to say it doesn't necessarily mean that the time jump can't be, you know, 5 years in the future or 5 months in the future. Or, I mean, honestly, the way it ends, I could, you know, the last book could pick up a week later, a year later, or a decade later. So yeah, I could be writing about a 65-year-old.
Oh, that'd be interesting. So you sort of rezone the whole thing. You should put Al Warren in the third one.
No,
I will. I will. You know what?
The murderer.
There's a lot of podcast references in this one, and there's a lot of and a few were fictional, a few are real. So if you know, it's impossible to do it accurately without talking about all the podcasts and the message boards and the websites. And that was a consistent editor note from Ed Schlesinger, who is a wonderful man who I'm working with at Gallery Books, and was more of the modern technology, Rich, and stop having yourself hang up the phone, because you don't hang up phones anymore, really.
Right.
He's like, you can tell you're in your 50s with, you know, your technology references stuff. So he was really integral to me kind of, you know, modernizing it, and because I had that stuff, I had it from the start, but he encouraged more of it.
God, I still write the words hang up if it's a cell phone issue. Is that not advised anymore?
You know what, I kept a couple of them in there.
Yeah
the way I write is very conversational, and I just wanted that, you know, in there. Because
what are you supposed to say? Turn off, like
disconnect, end the call,
disconnect. Oh, right,
okay. You know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
But it was more just, hey, Rich, a little less, you know, newspapers and, you know, television news, and a little bit more,
right,
you know, CNN.com on Twitter and all of that kind of thing.
Got it. Yeah, that's good. That's a good advisement.
But, you know, in my book, it's still called Twitter, so I'm already outdated.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly it goes. But I think most people are still calling it Twitter anyway.
So. I am. Yeah.
Twitter X.
Twitter X.
Yeah.
Did you ever figure out what the obsession was with true crime? Do you ever come to any sort of, you know, an idea of what, did you resolve that, kind of go, this is why people are so nuts about true crime?
I'm not sure you can resolve it. I'm honestly not sure you can. My opinion, my two cents, for whatever that's worth, is that it really does come down to this this quest for understanding. And maybe I'm putting too much weight in my own thought processes, because I do realize that that's very much what it's about for me. It's about trying to understand these human monsters, what makes them tick, how they got that way, whether, you know, there's some of them who, and I explore that in Becoming the Boogeyman, who, I think there's a chapter called The Making of the Monster, where you can see where the one of the guys in this book, you can see how he was made. You can see how that dark side of him was nurtured and fed through his youth, and where it brought him eventually. And then there's others who, you know, you read these true accounts of some serial killers who, you know, they grew up like I did. You know, and, you know, no family is perfect, but in relatively, you know, happy families, healthy families, healthy, you know, relationships, they were not abused. They were not, you know, exposed to this and that. And yet somehow they became fascinated with, you know, with killing and, or, you know, first harming. And then it progressed to that. So, for me, it's just about that wanting to understand. And there's a Stephen King book called From a Buick Gate, where it, kind of the entire underlying theme of the book is how sometimes there's a young man who's trying to come to terms with the death of his father, who was a state trooper. And by the end of the book, what he learns is that there are times when you just simply are never going to understand, and you can't just stand there shaking your fist at the sky all day, or you're going to lose your own life in the process and your own joy. And sometimes you have to walk away and accept those things. And I think very much that's what it's about for me, is trying to understand some things, but being healthy enough sometimes to just walk away.
It's a really weird thing, you know. And I know one of my last books, when I met the killer in prison and spent a couple of weeks with him, I don't know. My goal was to try and understand it better, but I don't know if we ever really will. Because people like that, there's something else going on besides the family and what they grew up around. I think that allows it to grow that way. But there's something else going on, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I would not disagree with that. I just think, for the most part, there's always going to be those cases where you can kind of fit it neatly into a box. But I think overall, it's just not meant to be understood. And you know, I respect the people who, you know, and law enforcement, yeah, the who are trying to understand it so they can prevent it and they can stop it. That's a hell of a way to make a living. And I'm glad. Like I said, I admire and respect them, but I'm glad it's not me, because the way my brain works, man, I'd be down that rabbit hole and I'd be divorced, and, you know, my kids would be like, you know, I'd be drinking and the whole thing. I would be a stereotype.
Yeah, I am. No.
Yeah.
No.
I was waiting.
I wasn't sure to go that way or not, but you know, it's an unusual business, and it causes. That's why I asked about how it feels for you, because when you write into that world, because I live in that world, and there's a lot of times certain cases, especially the modern ones, when you deal with them in the family and you go through all that experience, it really sort of has an effect on me personally and how I come out of it, and I don't always notice it until a few years later, you know. It's sort of, mm-hmm. So when you get into something that's very real, you know, because I mean, how do you respond to criticism, like people that are sort of not happy with you doing this book, for instance, or complaining or stuff like that? How does that affect you in a sense? Because I'd imagine you probably didn't get that much personal criticism before.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think 35 years being on the editorial side of the desk has helped just me have it, you know, been able to have kind of that healthy distance from any kind of criticism. Whereas I just, you know, right from the beginning, I understood that no matter how wonderful I thought a piece was, there were going to be people who read it in the magazine and took offense or just thought it was boring or didn't like it. So I just think that's been so kind of drummed into my mindset that I, you know, I, and most of the time as a writer, when you tell this to people, they don't believe you. Cause Ed Gorman, who was a mentor for me and crime writer, well, he wrote everything. And he published a lot of my early short stories. He was one of those guys who never believed me. I would try to tell him, be tougher on me, do this, you know, spit it out. And he's just like, he never believed that I had thick skin. And because I think there's a fair share of writers who say they do, and then they don't. But I've always been able to take it, and I've always been able to kind of just roll with it. And I don't listen to the praise very closely either. I just, you know, I went to college on a lacrosse scholarship. So I think that athletic background, you're constantly, you know, being guided and coached, critiqued, yelled at, the whole thing. So when it comes to writing, I think that really did suit me well.
Pretty amazing. So where are you off to next? Like what you're doing a standalone. Is it more backed into the horror, straightforward horror?
You know what? It's I'm working on the ending now. I'm working on those final like 10,000 words now. And this is, for me, this will dictate, you know, whether it ends up being, it's definitely a horror novel, but is it more of a thriller than it is horror, you know, similar to the Boogeyman books, or is it tip the scale the other way? It's another period piece. It's set back in 1983. It's, you know, three college students who it's a road trip novel. They're doing this road trip to do this project for American Studies class. They're doing a documentary on those roadside memorials that started popping up back in the 70s and 80s, kind of, you know, where an accident, you know, at an accident site, and the whole thing with the crosses and the flowers and all of that. And what it is they, as they're chronicling these different roadside memorials, they start recognizing that there's a similarity. There's something, and I can't get into that part of it too much, but they're starting to recognize some similarities that are on the ominous side. And the more they uncover, the more they're in danger. And takes place out in the Appalachians in Pennsylvania. So it's a pretty cool setting, and it's fun to go back in the 80s again and not have cell phones and all that stuff.
Do you ever think our time would become kind of like the flashback, the memories, you know what I mean? Like when we're growing up, we look back at the 60s and
I know.
And now it's everyone talking about the 80s. It must have been so cool to be alive in the 80s. Like, I get that.
Yeah. I get those smart ass comments. Like, you know, your book is set in 1988. You know, I was not born until 2001. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, it went fast.
Yeah. The weird thing is, I really think, and I know every generation says this to some extent or another, I really think it was better before. Like, I didn't think I'd be a person who ever said that, but I really, like, think the 90s was better than it is right now. Like, yeah, I'd be hard-pressed to imagine somebody disagreeing if they could compare the two side-by-side.
But being old, I think the 90s was, people were in a better mood.
Yeah.
Things were happier. Yeah. But I think we go through these trends, you know, back in the 60s and early 70s. It was really a tough time. All the assassinations and the riots and all this stuff going on. There was pretty intense feelings back then, and it was a bad mood. But it gets better. I think we just go through waves. I'm hoping. I mean.
it's cyclical. It's just a question. I agree that it goes in waves, but it's just a question of, like, will we see the wave change again? Like, is it going to happen in decades and we won't be here to see it?
I'm with you. I can't imagine anyone. Unfortunately, there probably are a fairly decent, you know, size section of people right now who are like, this is the best of times, you know, but no, not very many people who I know. They look back fondly.
Yeah.
My kids were chasing the Boogeyman. They wide-eyed. They're like, Dad, you guys roam the streets like a bunch of street urchins, you know? And they're like, you had such freedom. And I'm like, yeah. I said, you see those things on TV. It really was, you know, you checked in for lunch and, you looked for your friends. You found some. You were on an adventure. You came back for dinner. And then you weren't back in the house till dark, you know? And you could walk around at night and do this and that. And they were just very wide-eyed about that whole thing. And you could tell there was some longing there, and it was, yeah.
Yeah, rightfully so. I mean, yeah, it was a special time. I think, it's one thing to point to the internet and social media and addictive mobile devices, which causes all these toxic problems. But then once you add COVID and what has happened politically to it, it's like, yeah, how could you not find? And I hate to be that way, because I'm like, oh, I sound like an old man. Like, I'm only 45 and I'm still, yeah, I'm like, it would be nice if the pendulum swung and like Al said, you know, people's moods improve.
Yeah, hopefully. And like you said, hopefully we're here for that. I'm a decade older.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, they got to stop reading these awful horror books.
Yeah. These awful nostalgic horror books.
Yeah. Yeah. True crime books. That's the worst. You know.
Yeah. The true crime ones are really tough.
Oh, they're terrible.
Especially the photographs, and I try to tell people, you know, I'm like, look, you know, most of these books, they don't have graphic, you know, gory photos. And I said, they're not the ones that haunted me anyway. I said, it was honestly the ones where they showed like a patch of grass behind a shed in a suburban neighborhood and the grass is kind of pressed down and there's, you know, and that's the crime scene. That's where the young lady lost her life. And I would just stare at it because it was so normal. And I'm like, I've seen that scene, you know, a patch of grass behind a shed 100 times in my lifetime, and just to think that this person who did nothing wrong, you know, her life ended there. So those are the pictures that really haunted me, you know, just these really mundane everyday sights, but they had, you know, a different meaning.
Yeah, and I think I personally like to, with the more modern ones, I get it, the family survivors involved.
Yes.
I've got to be part of it. I even have some of them write a chapter, and some of them I want them to be in it, and I don't want to show pictures like that. I don't get into the gore. Like, I'm not going to sit there and talk about, you know, the blood dripping and going through all that.
Right.
There's other authors that'll do that. I personally want to get more into the behind the scenes and what's going on with their lives and how these things affect people that live on after the spotlight is gone.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, that's kind of how I tackle it, but it's still very hard. You know,
yeah, no, I can't imagine.
Well, listen, you're an easy guy to find, I'd imagine, but just for listeners that don't know, so where do people find you? Do you have a website? Do you have social media, all that stuff?
Yeah, I got pulled into social media kicking and screaming and ended up loving it. You know, to be able to hang out with readers and other writers, and because, like I said, I don't get out much, so that's fun. And I've been fortunate. I'm like one of the few who, like, you know, how many people have you had to block in a decade? I'm like, I don't know, 3 or 4. And they're like, what?
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter X and got a website and all that. So yeah, I'm really easy to find and almost always get back to people and enjoy doing it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Now we'll have your website, your book, everything up on our website so people can find it real easily in case they don't know who you are, but that's
wonderful.
Hard to believe. So the book, Becoming the Boogeyman, Richard Chizmar. So thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me back again. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.